Heidi Holton, thanks for choosing this KAXE-KBXE conversation. We are member-supported radio, a National Public Radio affiliate in northern Minnesota. We need your support for our radio broadcasts, our online content, and our podcast. Go to KAXE.org, and thanks for listening. Up next, a conversation on Dig Deep. Chuck Marone from Strong Towns, he's our conservative commentator. You're listening to Dig Deep. He's talking with Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator from Minnesota Brown, about socialism. This time, we're going to get into communism and fascism and China and the 20th century totalitarian states based on socialist ideas.
So the U.S. and the world found itself after World War One. In this kind of very strange place where we had just gone through the mechanized slaughter, I think is a fair place to say, of millions of people.
Right.
Something unprecedented in human history, something that people, you know, even years later, were just reeling from, could not figure out how to deal with it.
The worst war in history for reasons that people couldn't even figure out.
Couldn't understand, exactly. And so now you throw into that this idea of the people's uprising in what has now become the Soviet Union. And it's crazy because at the end of World War One, the Soviet Union made treaties with Germany to end their part of the war. And they basically gave Germany whatever they wanted. And the rationale was, it doesn't matter. The workers are going to rise up and take you over anyway. So whatever we agree with you now is going to be void 3 years from now when we're all comrades. There was a real sense of this was going to take over everything.
And that scare, in the United States, it was called the First Red Scare. I'm actually going to write a section of my book, this is a preview, where I look at, you know, what happened in Moscow when Vladimir Lenin took over and say that what Lenin did and what the people around him did directly influenced the decisions of Vic Power in Hibbing, Minnesota, because he was, Vic Power and a lot of American politicians were flirting with a form of socialism early in the 1900s, before World War One, that suddenly became a non-starter as soon as the Soviet Revolution took place. And that was a boom that hit the whole world. You know, the whole world had this reaction to that scare of what happened in Russia. And then we go, in the United States, we go through the roaring 20s and really capitalism. It really
the resurgence,
to, yeah,
right?
Yeah, you can kind of look at capitalism taking these bold steps. And a lot of these folks made their fortunes in this time. People like Herbert Hoover, for instance, who I think for the early part of the 20th century, Herbert Hoover is kind of this example of this beloved figure, benevolent capitalism on the march. Herbert Hoover is the intellectual and personification of what America ought to be, very popular.
Educated, intelligent.
And he's worked in real jobs. Yeah. He worked in mines, you know, and he's kind of this example of the self-made man. It was everything, and that was in the 1920s that this was kind of the vibe.
Let me put a modern label on it. The professional class.
Yeah.
The front row people. And so you see, like, even when we look back in history and look at the roaring 20s, we get this version of history about how, you know, the flappers and the, you know, this is like
Prohibition.
Yeah. Progressive policies.
Yeah,
you get this.
And, well, it's the end of progressivism. Progressivism really got, if it wasn't dead by World War One, the fear of socialism,
right,
killed off the rest of it.
Right. But you don't see like the machinations that are brewing into the Dust Bowl. You know, the huge amounts of financial leverage,
yep,
that created this illusion of wealth, in a sense, that would be destroyed in 1929.
The debt and the inflated values of all of these stocks.
The runaway speculation.
Speculation on commodities as well, yeah, as on companies. And that part, I think, we would recognize today because we've had it already happen with the housing bubble.
I feel like we're living through it.
And we might be seeing it again. I mean, we're in these cycles now where this is happening more often.
In the U.S. at this point, the second industrial revolution worldwide, our industrialization is a very easy way to paper over things by just creating a lot of debt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it crashes 1929 and we get, I mean, the Dust Bowl wasn't caused by the stock market, but yeah, the Dust Bowl coupled with the crash of the stock market and the double whammy just hits America like a punch. And it's really interesting. I was just having this conversation because I know we've talked about like Huey Long, and Huey Long's a figure that I've always studied, and I won't say I admire him, but I think he's worth studying because of what he and Franklin Roosevelt and others during the 1930s represented, which is a choose-your-own-adventure book for economic systems that we had back then that I don't think people really understood. Things could have gone very, very differently during that period. We could have lapsed into fascism like part of the world did. We could have lapsed into socialism or communism. We could have done any number of things, and what we got was what we got. And we all think like that was just what was going to happen. And Roosevelt, happy days are here again, and everything turned out good in the end. But if you lived through it, it could have been anything.
Right. I do find, and we've discussed this before, the National Socialism in Germany, and how it's really an incomplete story to talk about National Socialism without talking about the analog, which was their, you know, they had workers' revolutions on the left, you know, from a communist infiltration from Russia at that point as well. It was really a kind of an open question of where they would land. It was almost like two big competing giants, you know, in an arm wrestling match. And in Germany, you have National Socialism that won.
Yeah, mostly, well, I mean, there's a lot of theories about it, but part of it was Germany, the home of Marx and Engels and the socialist theories. The left was very divided, though, in Germany.
Right.
And also thrown off by the end of World War I. Of course, there's massive economic problems in Germany. And what emerges is the simplest thing tends to emerge from complicated things. They called it National Socialism. I do feel like Nazism is not a quintessential example of socialism.
Let me try to put out two, I think, commonalities, and then you can bat these away. I do think that, and I think this is important in our current conversation, there was a focus on, let's say, the workers or the people. A lot of the National Socialist rhetoric was about restoring to people things that were taken, had been taken from them by this elite ruling class and you know, to use Marxist term, the bourgeoisie, you know, but the National Socialists didn't talk that way, but they were very much about getting back to the people, the things that made Germany what it was.
But it was very, and I'd say that that's true. That's what they were saying. Heavy on the nationalism, heavy on this sense of pride and identity of a Germany that was, keep in mind, Germany was, it still is, a fairly young country. It formed
late 1800s.
Yeah, in the late 1800s, they have one of the world's great armies in World War I, and they still get beat. So this young country that had a great army got beat. Their people still have this pride, but they're getting killed by the economics of the situation and all this. And they go right back to the well. Or at least that's the appeal. Let's go, let's do it right this time and get this country right. And they have that kind of passion of a young country. And that's where this message of both nationalism, this pride, but also this scapegoating of the elites, that's where the socialism part of National Socialism came in. You know, the elites are making a profit off of your labor, but also having all sorts of people to blame, whether it was other countries, the past leaders, or the socialist parties that you thought you liked before, well, they're part of the problem. And then of course, the scapegoating of minority groups of all varieties, especially the Jews. And this nationalistic pride can clear away all that debris, and some great thing will emerge from this purification of this country. It's a wicked message that was effective.
Let me throw the socialism back into it, though, because unlike the Soviet socialism, you know, communism, which was state ownership of enterprises, and the state would run the farms, the state would run the industry, the state would run this, and it would give you a job and give you income and what have you. Mm-hmm. National socialism in Germany was the state would essentially like direct the businesses.
Yeah.
We would strip ownership from the evil people who had taken wealth.
But the right people would have ownership of the plants.
The quote-unquote right people.
Party members would be in positions of authority, and private industry would still exist. It would just exist at the pleasure of...
subservient to the state.
Of a very strong central government, of an authoritarian regime. But I think what we often miss when we talk about socialism is we tend to think of socialism and we immediately go to, because especially in America, I was just thinking about Rocky IV on the way over here, you know, and And
I like where this is going.
Yeah, you might like this one. Like, you know, Rocky IV, Rocky stopped communism.
Right.
I mean, by himself. I think part of the issue is we in America, because of our upbringing, because of Red Dawn and Rocky IV and all of this.
You and I are both in our mid-40s. Or yeah, no, you're early 40s.
I'm coming up on 40.
But it's we grew up in the same time.
I'm 39. But we grew up in the same 80s, time. 90s, that time, those movies.
Yeah.
I always tell the story of, I remember being at home, Saturday morning cartoons, Alvin and the Chipmunks came on, and the Chipmunks were giving a concert in Berlin, and they were singing about the wall coming down, and the wall did come down, and then like 3 or 4 months later, the real wall actually did fall, and for the kids of that era, like, I literally thought about the Chipmunks and how, God, the Chipmunks did it,
right?
You know, and just like Rocky IV, you know,
exactly.
Where Rocky did it. And so my point is that we tend to conflate socialism with authoritarianism.
Right.
Because I think when you look at when I grew up, the problem with Soviet Russia was the authoritarianism. You can't be free. You can't do things on your own. The state owns everything. But not just that, the police state, you're always being watched. Big brother, you know, this notion of authoritarianism. And that's the thing that I think that unites what happened in the Soviet Union under Stalin and what happened in Germany under Nazi Germany under Hitler. You can look at the authoritarianism and the expungement of perceived enemies as the thing that unites those two things. And I think, to be fair to those who would call themselves socialists, that is a totally different thing than what socialism as a principle is.
That's the part that is triggering to me,
Yeah. Obviously.
And I'm going to, you know, I said that in the last segment. Like, there's a part of me, and it's very hard to disentangle the totalitarian aspect from, you know, the theory. I mean, you look at Marx, and I don't think Marx's writing is calling for totalitarianism. I mean, it certainly is not. Yet, when you look at China, you look at Germany, you look at Russia turning into the Soviet Union, you know, we have some modern experiments that I want to talk about in the next segment a little bit. But you do have this long history of, okay, if we want to have these goals, you know, of equality and equity and what have you, in order to achieve those, we kind of have to resort to taking stuff and putting stuff right and coming in and making it, you know, making it right for the working class. And there is a certain amount of, and I think you can go right back to the French Revolution. There's a fine line between getting even with people and doing what's quote unquote the right thing. Depending on your vantage point, there might not be a lot of difference between those two things. And I think that's where the less you, I'll say this as someone who's a professional part of what would be the bourgeoisie, I think the less you have at stake, the less you have to lose, the more you're interested in guillotines and overthrowing the system. The more you have to lose, the more that stuff kind of freaks you out. And I think that's part of the
underlying
dynamic.
Only because that's your head in the guillotine.
That's your head in the guillotine,
yeah,
exactly.
And I think that part of this is when you find yourself as part of a majority that's oppressed by a minority of people, you find yourself wondering, well, how do we counteract this enormous power of the people who own the factories and the people who own, you know, the land? And this is stuff that we were dealing with on the range. You know, who owns the ore in the ground is a big question that existed then that still you could still debate it today. And the idea of how do we enforce, or maybe enforce is a authoritarian word, how do you govern inequality? How do you govern in an equal system? Knowing that one person, one vote is one way to govern, but that votes and things are influenced strongly by political power. And power is the real issue here. How do you close the gap between the most powerful and the least powerful so that they're maybe not everybody the same, but that there's some way to keep those power distances close enough? You look at socialism, it's a field of failed experiments in a lot of ways, whether it's Soviet Union, we're watching what's happening in China, and there's a potential, I mean, maybe in our lifetimes, there's a potential for another revolution in China that will look different than the one that happened in the late 40s and 50s. But we're watching, you know, whether it's all of the failed communist governments in Latin America, there's all of these failures to go off of, but the goal remains there. And the idea of, like, you know, there's other places in the world, Scandinavia, maybe this is where we get into some of the modern discussion. What happens if you don't make it authoritarian and you really truly just make it about policy and public governance? You can do this peacefully and you can do it without guillotines or murders or camps or any of those.
Let's talk about that in the next segment, because mm-hmm. I think that's a fascinating thing. I will posit this, though. I think we look at the rhetoric of the right in this country and in other countries, and we are correctly alarmed when the rhetoric starts to go into places where we know it's gone bad. Mm-hmm. Nationalist tendencies that go too far are not healthy. When we talk about the supremacy of one group over another, that goes bad. That, like, those are lines that when we cross them, they raise all kinds of red flags, not only because we just know them to be like an incorrect way to look at the world, but even beyond that, we can just look back in history and see. Like,
plenty this of examples.
Is, this is the language of despots and totalitarians. Mm-hmm. On the other side, though, we're very blasé about the language of the left, because it's kind of shielded in this compassion or making sure there's equity or equality or people get. But when you look at that language has been used in the last 100 years, even more than the language on the right, to lead to mass starvation. Let's go out in China and kill everyone who has wearing glasses, because those are the people who are the intellectuals who are reading. We're very, very accepting of what I think is really, really radical, crazy language sometimes on the socialist left, saying, yeah, you know, there's some happy examples of socialism. We don't have to go to these places that other people have gone by dividing this group mm-hmm. and saying, these are the people who have taken from you. These are the people who have and you don't. These are the people we need to go after. And that's where I kind of start to get, okay, I'm I can have this conversation, but
this is the authoritarian argument again.
Right,
you know, you're what you're talking about is authoritarianism and fear of being challenged and so authoritarian regimes will exert great power and great cruelty to maintain power. You can put a socialist label on that. You can put a fascist label on that. You can call it democratic. And we did. I mean, we committed genocide in the United States of America, and we lived in a democracy. But it's authoritarianism is your problem. The socialism, yes, it may or may not be the right choice. I'll just leave that out there for people to decide. But you can't say that, you know, because China had an authoritarian regime that negates the idea of what socialist policy might look
like. I'll grant you that. And let's maybe in the next segment talk about, is it possible to have socialism without totalitarianism?
Yeah, that's a good way to go.
Yeah, and what would that actually look like? Because I'm skeptical.
Mm-hmm. I kind of picked that up.